Second, we may note here a very interesting fact about the chief temples of Egypt and, so far as we know, because the ruins are not so distinct, of Babylonia, and that is that they were oriented, that's to say, that the same sort of temple was built so that the shrine and entrance always faced in the same direction. In Babylonian temples, this was most often due east, facing the sunrise on March the 21st and September the 21st, the equinoxes. And it's to be noted that it was at the spring equinox that the Euphrates and Tigris came down in flood. The pyramids of Giza are also oriented east and west, and the Sphinx faces due east. But very many of the Egyptian temples to the south of the delta of the Nile don't point due east, but to the point where the sun rises at the longest day, and in Egypt the inundation comes close to that date. Others, however, pointed nearly northward, and others again pointed to the rising of the star Sirius, or to the rising point of other conspicuous stars. The fact of orientation links up with the fact that there early arose a close association between various gods and the sun and various fixed stars. Whatever the mass of people outside were thinking, the priests of the temples were beginning to link the movements of those heavenly bodies with the power in the shrine. They were thinking about the gods they served and thinking new meanings into them. They were brooding upon the mystery of the stars. It was very natural for them to suppose that these shining bodies, so irregularly distributed and circling so solemnly and silently, must be charged with portents to mankind. Among other things, this orientation of the temples served to fix and help the great annual festival of the new year. On one morning in the year, and one morning alone, in a temple oriented to the rising place of the sun at midsummer day, the sun's first rays would smite down through the gloom of the temple and the long alley of the temple pillars and light up the god above the altar and irradiate him with glory. The narrow, darkened structure of the ancient temples seems to be deliberately planned for such an effect. No doubt the people were gathered in the darkness before the dawn. In the darkness there was chanting and perhaps the offering of sacrifices. The god alone stood mute and invisible. Prayers and invocations would be made. Then, upon the eyes of the worshippers, sensitized by the darkness, as the sun rose behind them, the god would suddenly shine. So, at least, one explanation of orientation is found by such students of orientation as Sir Norman Lockyer. Not only is orientation apparent in most of the temples of Egypt, Assyria, Babylonia, and the East, it's found in the Greek temples. Stonehenge is oriented to the midsummer sunrise, and so are most of the megalithic circles of Europe. The altar of heaven in Peking is oriented to midwinter. In the days of the Chinese Empire, up to a few years ago, one of the most important of all the duties of the Emperor of China was to sacrifice and pray in this temple upon Midwinter's Day for a propitious year. The Egyptian priests had mapped out the stars into the constellations and divided up the zodiac into 12 signs by 3000 BC. Third, this clear evidence of astronomical inquiry and of a development of astronomical ideas is the most obvious, but only the most obvious evidence of the very considerable intellectual activities that went on within the temple precincts in ancient times. There's a curious disposition among many modern writers to deprecate priesthoods and to speak of priests as though they had always been impostors and tricksters, preying upon the simplicity of mankind. But indeed, they were for long the only writing class, the only reading public, the only learned and the only thinkers. They were all the professional classes of the time. You could have no intellectual life at all. You couldn't get access to literature or any knowledge except through the priesthood. The temples weren't only observatories and libraries and clinics. They were museums and treasure houses. The original Periplus of Hanno hung in one temple in Carthage, skins of his gorillas were hung and treasured in another. Whatever there was of abiding worth in the life of the community sheltered there. Herodotus, the early Greek historian, who lived from 485 to 425 BC, collected most of his material from the priests of the countries in which he travelled, and it's evident they met him generously and put their very considerable resources completely at his disposal. Outside the temples, the world was still a world of blankly illiterate and unspeculative human beings, living from day to day entirely for themselves. Moreover, there's little evidence of the commonality felt cheated by the priests or had anything but trust and affection for the early priesthoods. Even the great conquerors of later times were anxious to keep themselves upon the right side of the priests of the nations and cities whose obedience they desired because of the immense popular influence of these priests. No doubt there were great differences between temple and temple and cult in the spirit and quality of the priesthood. Some probably were cruel, some vicious and greedy, many dull and doctrinaire, stupid with tradition. But it has to be kept in mind that there were distinct limits to the degeneracy or inefficiency of a priesthood. It had to keep its grip upon the general mind. It couldn't go beyond what people would stand, either towards the darkness or towards the light. Its authority rested, in the end, on the persuasion that its activities were propitious. Fourth, the earliest civilized governments were essentially priestly governments. It wasn't kings and captains who first set men to the plough and a settled life. It was the ideas of the gods and plenty, working with the acquiescence of common men. The early rulers of Sumer, we know, were all priests, kings only because they were chief priests. And priestly government had its own weaknesses as well as its peculiar, deep-rooted strength. The power of a priesthood is a power over their own people alone. It's a subjugation through mysterious fears and hopes. The priesthood can gather its people together for war, but its traditionalism and all its methods unfitted for military control. Against the enemy without, a priest-led people is feeble. Moreover, a priest is a man vowed, trained, and consecrated, a man belonging to a special corps, and necessarily with an intense esprit de corps. He has given up his life to his temple and his God. This is a very excellent thing for the internal vigor of his own priesthood, his own temple. He lives or dies for the honor of his particular god. But in the next town or village is another temple with another god. It's his constant preoccupation to keep his people from that god. Religious cults and priesthoods are sectarian by nature. They will convert, they will overcome, but they will never coalesce. Our first perceptions of events in Sumer, in the dim, uncertain light before history began, is of priests and gods in conflict. Until the Sumerians were conquered by the Semites, they were never united, and the same incurable conflict of priesthoods scars all the temple ruins of Egypt. It was impossible that it could have been otherwise, having regard to the elements out of which religion arose. It was out of those two main weaknesses of all priesthoods, namely the incapacity for efficient military leadership and their inevitable jealousy of all other religious cults, that the power of secular kingship arose. The foreign enemy either prevailed and set up a king over the people, or the priesthoods, who would not give way to each other, set up a common fighting captain who retained more or less power in peacetime. This secular king developed a group of officials about him and began, in relation to military organization, to take a share in the priestly administration of the people's affairs. So, growing out of priestcraft and beside the priest, the king, the protagonist of the priest, appears upon the stage of human history, and a very large amount of the subsequent experiences of mankind is only to be understood as an elaboration, complication, and distortion of the struggle, unconscious or deliberate, between these two systems of human control, the temple and the palace. And it was in the original centers of civilization that this antagonism was most completely developed.